Okay, I've got several. You're already on the list, and everybody that's on the list has been here before, and they got in like in 5 minutes as we started. I want to give Raul a moment just to reply quickly, and then we'll get these people in the list.
I felt like.
Wait, why did you snooze? Why did you do that snoozy sound when I mentioned the King of Jordan?
Because I cannot believe you brought up the Hashemites as an example. I mean, King Abdullah rules through one reason. He rules because of the General Intelligence Directorate. If it were not for it in the blue rooms where he takes the individuals he doesn't like and treats them in very unkind ways, the monarchy would go down.
I actually disagree.
The monarchy's in horrendous shape.
It is
becoming a wholly owned subdivision of the Saudi monarchy. You now actually having not just Palestinians who are really beginning to hate the king, which didn't used to be the case. I mean, the Palestinian percentage in Jordan may be as high as 80%. It's definitely 70%. If it were not for the...
In his bed, it's 50%.
If it were not for the teeny-weeny slice of the East Bankers who maintain this sort of Iraq-style overlordship over the Palestinians... I think the Hashemites would be in deep doo-doo if it were not for the subventions of the Saudis, if it were not for the extraordinary accomplishments of the Intelligence Directorate and also CIA's subventions to the Intelligence Directorate.
No, look, I'll give you that. I'll give you that he's in power. Well, first of all, you neglected to mention the Israelis, who have a vested
Israelis
interest in keeping
too.
Him. But after spending weeks there in over the last 4 or 5 months, I would say that while the bloom is off the rose, that there's no 15 years ago when he came into power, 16 years ago, 14, 15, when he came into power, there was a lot of romance associated with him. The romance is gone between the people and the king, but what he has going for him more than anything else is the condition of the rest of the region. I mean, this is one of the things. You know, I mean, you talk about the monarchy is in horrendous shape. The opposition in Jordan has not been able to muster more than 2,500, 3,000 people to a demonstration. There's a reason for that, and it's not just the intelligence service. The reason is that Jordanians now fear instability and violence that they see to their north, and they fear the chaos of Egypt, and they certainly loathe the chaos that they see to their east in Anbar province. They fear and loathe that much more than they dislike their king. And so
that used to be said after the Iraq War, during the Iraq War. There were some very embarrassing articles written by very famous journalists. I'll not enumerate them right now. I'll do it later. None are in this room, where they said, oh, the model of Iraq, all its troubles, it's set back democracy for ages in the Middle East. Egypt in particular is never going to go the democratic way because they can see the troubles in Iraq. Boom, less than 5 years later, it's rolling. I would be very skeptical of that argument. I think the only thing that King Abdullah has truly accomplished is he now can use the subjunctive when he conjugates Arabic verbs. He didn't used to be able to do that. In fact, he didn't handle the present or past tense all that well.
Give us an example.
He can say yakuna, to be, and he basically puts out the A at the end of it. But, I mean, he actually didn't used to – he didn't know his own language. He really didn't. He was a product of English, not Arabic. I would just say this. I think the trajectory of fundamentalism in Jordan has gone only one way. It's about like that. And that is what you expect. Jordan is not all that different from any of the states in the region. Wherever you have an authoritarian state engaged in the practices that authoritarian states must use, Islamic fundamentalism grows. The Hashemites have done wonders. They've been able to stay in power under extraordinarily difficult circumstances. So I would never say the Hashemites are toast, because they've always been able to pull the rabbit out of the hat. But I would just say that the terrible practices that King Hussein and now his son engaged in, financial practices, corruption, nepotism, all these other things, are beginning to finally come down. And they're losing, the Hashemite monarchy is losing the support of not just the Palestinians, who are absolutely critical to this whole thing, but they're also beginning to lose the support of East bankers. The only thing that holds them in power is the East banker fear of the Palestinians. That's the primary thing that holds them in power. Now, I'll just say a couple little things. I thought Jeffrey was beginning to engage in a certain nostalgia that, again, is becoming more common in the United States. It's also in Europe, as you begin to see the difficulties of the Great Arab Revolt. You see the political agenda is becoming clearer. It's still not clear yet. It will become even. It will become clearer, and I guarantee you. It
so my agenda or the Arab agenda?
Arab agenda.
Not that they're different.
No, your agenda is different. It will become more depressing. I mean, listen, I mean, minorities in the Middle East have had a really bad time for the last 150 years. One of the downsides of westernization creating the nation state in the Middle East was actually it reduced the guarantees of minorities. The minorities actually had a better time under the Ottoman Empire, because as long as they would cede the public square, they were guaranteed their own security within their own communities. Nationalism, the introduction of nationalism where everybody becomes a citizen, actually diminished for them that position. So in Turkey, you have the surreal position. For example, no Turk says to a Christian, says Turk.
I want to get these folks in, and I'm loving what this is wonderful. But
okay, I'll pass now.
You done that?
No, the only other thing here is on women's issues and Jeffrey's remark on bikinis. That's absolutely true, but the objective is compromise. In the Islamic Republic of Iran, they don't have any place where they engage in this sort of infidel compromise. If Egypt actually can and Tunisia can create places where foreign women can come in, it is a significant compromise. It is something that shows that the regime isn't as dogmatic mm-hmm. as other Islamists are elsewhere. And that's what you want to see. You want to see the little tiny shreds of pragmatism that actually can grow and have repercussions elsewhere in society.
Okay. I have Carl Cannon here first. Pull the microphone over. Then Amy Sullivan and Paul Ewert, Sally Quinn, Dole, and Fred, and Britt. Be concise.
Okay.
Carl Cannon?
Yes. I actually have a question for each gentleman, and they're different questions. But they're quick.
Sure.
Jeff, you said that one of the things that's going on there, and you've written about this, is the disintegration of the existing borders, that the collapse of those countries that were driven up. And my question to you is, if that process happens, when do the Kurds get a homeland? Because that seems to me to be a real one, recognized by the UN, a country of their own. And, you mentioned, and I think most people here are aware of it, that how dominant women's issues are in this whole Islamic story of theirs. And I guess my question is, to be not cynical, but to really examine it, it's so extreme from our standpoint. My question is that really the organizing principle, or is it a pretext, religion itself, Islam, a pretext for really continuing subjugation of women and keeping women in a place? And it's really just an excuse. And that the real goal is oppressing women.
Who wants to go first? He wants you to go first.
Go ahead.
No, I don't think the real goal is that. Listen, I mean, we have come so far from where we were in the West. And I was going to tweak Jeffrey a bit. I mean, one of the things that I always found interesting when I listen to Westerners talk about the Islamic world, they tend to have a bit of amnesia of how bad modernity was in the West. I mean, modernity is a bitch. It's lethal. I mean, the West is built on only one thing, blood. We grew out of a sea of blood. Until the Treaty of Augsburg in 1555, the Germans, they killed one-third of the population as the Protestants and Catholics went after it. One-third of the population. And that's just one example. You can go through all of Europe and the body count just rises and rises and rises. I actually suspect Muslims will do better. You, Yeah, I think when it comes to women, I mean, it is a traditional society. And the ethical structures that they have that are incorporated into the faith and incorporated into the into local cultures are built upon female honor. And so I don't think you can separate the faith from this issue. It is deeply, deeply intertwined. And there is something that you have to say about Muslim societies wherever you find them, and the great variations, you know, from if you go to Morocco all the way to Indonesia, the great variations to how Muslims order themselves. But the one thing you can home is they've created very stable family structures. You may not like that family structure, but it's quite profound. Bob Kaplan had a very astute observation when he was observing the ghettos of Brazil and Latin America, and then he went to observe the ghettos and the shanty towns of the Muslim world, and they're horrendous ones in the Muslim world. But what he noted, and he's quite right, is that the family structure was actually much more solid in the horrendous poverty-stricken areas of the Muslim world. It held. The Muslim family structure, which is at the core of their identity, does definitely put the woman in an inferior second-class position. There's absolutely no doubt about it. But it has been a model which has sustained itself. And what is happening is that we're now introducing, and they are actually taking, it's not a case of imperialism. This is where people like Edward Said just lose it. It's not imperialists who bring in Western culture. It's they themselves who adopt it and bring it in and like it. There are many aspects of it that they want it. But at the same time, it causes a great deal of internal friction. It's corrosive to the traditional order. And I think what we have to be careful of is that when they hear us talk, what they hear us saying is that, all right, we're going to have a democracy. And according to the way you want it, if you win, you win. If I win, you win too.
Okay. Jeffrey?
Very quickly.
We have a long list.
Very quickly. The Kurds will get a state when they figure out how to make the Jews their enemy. I mean, at least they'll get attention for their cause. But poor schmucks picked the wrong enemy. They would get on the cover of the New York Times magazine, you know, if they just somehow figured out a way to get Israel pissed off at them. The chances are actually good. I mean, one of the things that we undervalue, obviously, about the Iraq War, and I just had this extended email conversation with the Prime Minister of Kurdistan about this, you know, is that the Kurds were freed by the Americans from the threat of further genocide at the hands of Saddam Hussein. They were already on a trajectory because of the no-fly zone. They were already on a positive trajectory. I'm talking about just the Iraqi Kurds. They are in better shape than they've ever been. They still pay lip service, at least, to the idea of a unitary Iraq, Arab-dominated unitary Iraq. But they're fighting tremendously with the central government over their oil. They're going to cut side deal with Turkey. They're already, Kurdish kids, this is interesting, don't learn Arabic anymore in their schools. I mean, these are citizens of Iraq, yeah. Citizens of Iraq who, you know, millions now, who just don't know Arabic. I mean, the language of the rest of the country. I mean, it is moving in that direction. And obviously, Kurds and other ethnic minorities that have been stateless because they've been dominated by an Arab-Muslim-Sunni majority, or in serious cases, in Alawi, minority do have some opportunities here, and so it wouldn't surprise me if Kurdistan figures out a way to Iraqi Kurdistan, at least, figures out a way to break free. And I think in Syria we'll have a de facto Kurdish quasi independent mountain redoubt or something, because I think Syria, that's the way Syria is going. It's going to break apart. There's a good chance of that.
Okay, Amy Sullivan and then Paul Edwards.
I wanted to push back against the idea that secularization and westernization of a Muslim country will almost always lead to fundamentalist rule. I think it's not surprising when you have the secularization of a culture that there will be things about a kind of the opposite approach, like the Muslim Brotherhood, that will appeal to people. But it doesn't have to be necessarily the only answer. That, you know, to take your example, the women at the University of Cairo, you know, may decide that as their form of kind of protest that they'll start veiling themselves, doesn't necessarily mean that they need to go all the way to embracing the theology and the cultural goals of the Muslim Brotherhood. That said, I wonder how difficult it is and how much evidence there is that there is any sort of middle ground movement in a place like Egypt, or that the Muslim Brotherhood would allow something like that to emerge, where you would have a vehicle for protesting some of the excesses of Westernization without actually moving all the way to the Muslim Brotherhood's positions.
I think, you know, the best model on this is probably Turkey. And, you know, Ataturk was an astonishing, enlightened dictator. I mean, what he did, I mean, one, just changing the language. People tend to, you know, ignore that issue. But, I mean, that's the most fundamental change I think you can do. And to just one day, you know, have the Ottoman script, which is a variation of Arabic, the Arabic script, and then, boom, you're using the Latin script is a truly, you know, shocking, and it was incredibly successful maneuver on his part to reorient Turks from the Islamic world towards Europe. Ataturk was very explicit in saying that Europe is, there's only one civilization in the world, and that civilization is European. I mean, that would never be said in the Arab world. Yet, you know, it's been quite clear you could not shear off 600 years of history. And the Justice and Development Party is returning those 600 years of history. You can't force-feed Muslims. And that has been the pattern now since World War II, is that the modernizing autocrats, be they presidents for life or kings, would force-feed Muslims and create little Westerners, except in the Middle East. It didn't work. If there's going to be change, that change has to be organic. You cannot import Belgian or Swiss constitutions and Western legal codes and expect them to have traction in those societies and be accepted as legitimate. I think you have to have all of that be done organically. That's why it's a great mistake that the Middle East went so profoundly in the direction of military dictatorship after World War II, because that was the path towards modernity. And that cut off that organic evolution that you actually saw occurring in the late 19th century. So I think unless you have that organic growth, the enforced secularism always has produced a significant growth in the religious identity, an extraordinarily fertile ground for Islamic fundamentalism.
But you're not talking about enforced secularism, right? I mean, you know, I would only say that based on what I know of the Muslim Brotherhood, the answer is no, they're not interested in creating space for actual powerful dissenting voices that are Islamist light, or however you might want to put it. You know, they know their country, and they understand that the power, especially outside the city, is with them. And there's nothing, you know, I always, and I've had 2 years of debates about the Muslim Brotherhood, you know, on this, and I always remind people.
With who?
No, just anywhere, you know. I mean, you know, there's a in Tenleytown at the 7-Eleven. It's weird, right? No, there's the, you know, I always remind people, you know, that there's a great desire, and you know, now I'm being anti-nostalgia, anti-sentimental, anti-whatever Royal was talking about. There's a great desire to imagine that they're like us, I'm talking about the leadership of the Muslim Brotherhood, or the ideology of the Muslim Brotherhood. You know, we it comforts us. It makes us feel like, you know, we're all alike. We all want the same things. And every president, no matter what party, has to always say, well, we all want the same things. No, they actually want something different. And if you actually, you know, the creed of the, I'll read it to you. The creed of the Muslim Brotherhood is very simple. Allah is our objective. The Prophet is our leader. Quran is our law. Jihad is our way. Dying in the way of Allah is our highest hope. It's not from the DNC, you know? I mean, it's, you know, I mean, it's admirably straightforward, you know? But what they've done is they've adopted the tactics of political parties, which is to say, you know, a little etch-a-sketch thing never hurts, and a little bit of subterfuge and a little bit of marketing. But they are what they are. And you know, and to quote Erdogan, who I think is just a more clever version of Morsi, you know, I think that Erdogan is, the Prime Minister of Turkey, who is, you know, you consider, people refer to him as a soft Islamist, but ultimately he's moving his country in a direction that obviously a lot of secular Turks find very disagreeable. I mean, he is the one who said when he was still mayor of Istanbul, I think, you know, democracy is like a train. You ride it until you get to your stop, and then you get off. I think we see that, you know, Turkey has more journalists in jail than almost any other country in the world at this point. I think we understand where his loyalty is. You know, I don't think that these parties, once they gain power, are very interested in having a multiplicity of real voices. And that's just my take.
Can I just add one quick thing on that? People need to pay close attention to what the Muslim Brotherhood and Islamists write, and you must take it seriously. I think there's a tendency in the West, one, because it's hard to read that stuff. It's actually not easy.
Not pleasant?
It's not pleasant to read. I mean, yeah. My friend Ian Baruma was looking at trying to understand Tariq Ramadan and some other European Islamists, and I said, he asked me, what should I read? And I gave him a whole list of books to read, and he came back to me like 2 or 3 weeks later, almost in tears. He says, God, this stuff's awful. I mean, it's tough to read. It's not fun.
Well, look, if you buy, by the way, like Qaradawi, the main Muslim Brotherhood style thinker in the Sunni world,
yeah.
You know, get these guys, get their books on, you know, the organization of family life and read the sections about when it's permissible and when it's not to beat your wife. It's there. I mean, it's just all there. It's not, you're right, it's not fun to read. You know, don't leave a mark. Explain to her while you're beating her how she created the situation in which it was necessary to have this beating. I mean, it's ugly.
I saw Qaradawi reduce Richard Holbrooke to tears. That's not an easy thing to do.
Only Susan Rice could do that.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're going to take a break in a moment, but before we do, Paul Edwards' question will take us into the break. Paul Edwards, and then we're going to take a 10-minute break, and I've got everybody else on the list. If you waved at me, you're on the list.
You gave us the Islamist narrative about the Jews. What is the narrative about the Copts in Egypt? How do they frame that? And I have two questions. They're quite different. The second question is, do the Emirates provide any sort of model for cosmopolitanism within the Arab world?
You do the first. I'll do the second.
That's a good question on the Copts. The Copts are tricky because the Copts are such an old community. They are the, you know, the first Egyptians. I would answer it two ways. I think within the Islamist movements in Egypt, it's divided. There are those that look upon the Copts in the traditional way that Muslims look upon a Christian minority, and that is they're part of the woodwork. And they're an accepted part of the community within restrictions.
Remember? As long as they know their place.
Right. You got to remember, it's the public square. Mm-hmm. I don't think you have to worry about too much. I mean, they're not nice by any Western standard, but they're not lethal. There are then those like the Salafists who have almost a very, don't have a traditional attitude towards the Copts, who actually look at the Copt presence as being insidious, as being a means for Western culture to penetrate into Egypt. And that's historically not untrue, because the minorities, and particularly the Christian communities, have usually been the cutting edge of Westernization. And there it gets harsher. I would say that the first view is likely to prove predominant. But I'll be honest, when I was a student in Egypt in the 1970s, early 1980s, if I'd go over to the American embassy back then, the lines would extend forever, and almost everybody in them were Copts. All right. So
what did they want?
Leaving. They wanted to go to America. This has been the pattern of religious minorities in the Middle East for 150 years. I hate to say it because I love the complex cosmopolitan culture of the Middle East, which was vastly more cosmopolitan than the culture of Europe. It's dying, if not dead. We will see within our lifetimes probably the end of the great Christian minority communities of the Middle East. The Jewish communities died out. The Christian communities, in all probability, will too.
One very quick point on that, which is comes back to something Roel said. I'm not actually that much of an optimist on the peace process. One of the reasons I'm not actually that much of an optimist on the peace process is precisely this trend. The Middle East is an inhospitable place for ethnic and religious minorities. The idea that the Middle East can absorb a Jewish national state that demands equality within the framework of the Middle East is too much for people to bear. I mean, in other words, the Middle East conflict is both unique in some ways, but it's also very much part of a pattern that if you can understand the Arab-Sunni majority opinion about Israel by looking at the way Copts are treated in Egypt, the way Kurds are treated in Iraq, the way blacks were treated in Sudan before South Sudan broke off, and so on. I mean, no minority, ethnic, religious, otherwise, has an easy time in the Middle East. It's not, there's a real desire for purification and a desire for dominance in the culture, and there's just no way around it. Very quickly, your first question. Since I am a person, I'm comfortable holding up Jordan as a possible small-scale model, even though Mr. Anti-Monarchy over here doesn't agree with me. I'm not prepared to hold up UAE it's a family with a flag and a lot of American weaponry. These are countries whose the citizen base is 600,000, 700,000. The population is mostly foreign workers. They are afloat on a sea of oil, and they could buy so much with that oil, including a level of quiet that you can't buy in most countries. So they're not really. I mean, it's a nice place to go shopping, and obviously Saudis like to go over there to not be in Saudi Arabia for a few days. These are enjoyable places in some ways, but they're a model. They're not really a model for anything.
I'd say that one quick point that I think Bali Nasser made an astute point in his book on the forces of fortune. I think the UAE actually helped make Islamic fundamentalism chic, in that you had very religious people become very, very wealthy, and they had the means to convey through television and advertising a wealth associated with a new vibrant Islamic identity. It wasn't a Western identity. It was a vibrant Islamic identity. So that is a significant contribution, I think, of the Gulf Sheikhdoms. Beyond that, I think they have no redeeming virtues or no applicability whatsoever to anywhere else in the Middle East.
Okay, on that upbeat note, what we're going to do now is take a 10-minute break. I've got 8 of you on the list to come in, and let's try to be disciplined about the break so we can get back with these gentlemen as quickly as possible. Thank you.
Excellent. Please join us. We want to get engaged again here. Ladies and gentlemen, if I could have your attention for a moment, I need to make one very complicated announcement. At lunch today, it's going to be plated where we had breakfast. And on that, to expedite our service, as you leave this room, you'll be given either a green ticket or an orange ticket. The orange ticket means you want pasta, and the green ticket means you want chicken wrap.
And you take that ticket and you put it on your plate. And that way, the servers will just take your ticket and put it on. So let me repeat. Green.
He's a journalist who will not understand this. Complicated. I can't follow what you're talking
yes.
about.
Green means you get a chicken wrap, and orange means pasta. And so when you leave here, Jessica will hand.
See?
You'll find out when it lands on your plate. So as you leave the door, Jessica will be handing out little green and orange tickets.
Wait, which one is orange again?
pasta, orange. Green, chicken wrap. Okay. Should we say that in unison? Now, everyone, I want to get everybody in as best we can, and we have about 8 people on the list, and others won't be added. So I would like to ask both our people asking questions to continue to be concise and for our answers to be as concise as possible so that we can get through the list, because I'm eager to hear from all of you. And so if I interrupt, it's because I'm just trying to keep it moving. Sally Quinn, you're first. Please pull the microphone up to you, and when I call on you, please bring the mic up.
I'm interested in the Egyptian opposition and what's wrong with them. I mean, we all know that Morsi is an uninteresting, sort of boring pedestrian character who probably would not have gotten elected if the opposition hadn't been divided. I was particularly interested that when John Kerry went to Egypt, that al-Baradei refused to meet with him and some of the other opposition leaders. And I don't get it. I mean, it just seems to me that if they would pull themselves together, they might be able to do something. The idea that they wouldn't even meet with the Secretary of State just seemed to me really self-destructive, given the fact that Morsi doesn't have that kind of charismatic personality or really that kind of following.
Gentlemen? Jeff, you want to go first?
No.
You want him to go first. You like to react to it, right?
I mean, I would agree with everything you just said. I think it was a pretty stupid move, but I think it was expected.
Did he not meet?
Yeah, that they wouldn't do that. I mean, al-Baradei, I mean, he's got issues, but I think they were reacting to the slow way the administration responded to the Egyptian rebellion, the protests, and they mistakenly held a grudge on that issue. All of the opposition, which is under the age of 25, suffers from the problem that all people under the age of 25 suffer from. They're usually fairly stupid. that I don't know. That doesn't set the Egyptians apart. Sorry, Gabby, you did. I didn't mean that. But they, you know, they don't have any practice. They don't have any tradition. The one thing you can say about, Egypt under Mubarak, as under Sadat and under Nasser, I mean, you don't really get any Lessex and civic virtues. So I suspect they will get better. You know, it's going to take time, but I think they'll get better and they'll learn to identify those things that are really important to them and sort of calm themselves for those issues now that they get quite passionate about and really aren't that relevant.
But aren't they the sort of future of secularism?
Yes.
So if they pull together, they might be able to overwhelm the...
I don't think they'll be able to...
That you're assuming that the majority of Egyptians are secular-minded.
Yeah, I don't think they'll be able to...
It's a very, very, very religious country. The Muslim Brotherhood is very,
more,
very organized and very tough party.
Are there more Salafists than there are...
Well, when you said the Egyptian opposition, you could go two ways with that.
Right.
I mean, there's opposition to the right as well as to the left. The Muslim Brotherhood has a 60-year jump in organizing. Yeah. And these secularists, these, you know, the Google kids, the Facebook revolution, that was, you know, chimerical. That was, you know, that they opened the square. They did. But they don't have the numbers or the support, and people look at them as they look at foreigners. You know, they're not in the mainstream of that society.
That's the biggest problem that the secular liberal crowd, however one wants to slice it, has always had in the Middle East, is how do they make themselves authentic? Because they are obviously an import. Their ideas are imported. So how do you take an imported idea, root it in the ground, and become authentic, and so someone can't attack you for essentially being a conveyor, a vehicle for foreign ideas? It's a real problem, and it's one that Muslim secularists, liberals, have not been able yet, I think, to successfully deal with.
Before I call on others, could I just make an announcement? Some of you expressed a concern. It's a little chilly in here. I don't want to get real hot, but if we could just turn the AC down, whoever knows where that switch is, it would be nice if we turned it down. Let me tell you who's up. Dole, you're up next. Dole McManus, Fred Barnes, and then Britt Hume and Rob Gifford, John Senup, Tim Dalrymple, John Ward. So Dole McManus and then Fred.
What about women? It's like a Muslim Brotherhood meeting.
Yeah, what's that?
You're the token women vice president of Egypt. That's what you
are. Dole McManus?
All right, let me try and help the heating situation by asking about the Middle East peace process. Rael, to paraphrase you ruthlessly, I think I heard you say, look, the peace process is not going to result in Islamists or Muslim believers embracing the state of Israel, because that's theologically impossible. Okay. But two things. Number one, are you raising the bar too high for any peace process? And second, is the correct inference from what you said, so forget about it until the Islamic world completes this debate, because otherwise a peace process can't really have any utility. And, of course, I'd like Jeff to respond to that, because he's written passionately and brilliantly about the various utilities of the peace process, but I'd also like Jeff to answer the question, as our modern Moses, so was Moses a Muslim or a Jew?
I'll let Jeffrey take the bulk of this one. I'll just say I think Palestinians should vote. Let the Palestinians decide by...
In which state?
Both. You don't get separated. That's a misnomer. Let them vote. So let's see who wins in elections between Fatah and Hamas. And then let's see whether either one really wants to have an agreement with Israel, and let them vote about it. But don't fall back to that traditional American response, which is, elections. I was in the State Department on the day the election returns came back, and a certain very senior
the 2006 Hamas election.
A certain very senior State Department official who will go unmentioned was shocked. That Hamas had done so well, and I looked at him and said, "You must be kidding." But that's also not to say that that Fatah, let's be honest, Fatah is not exactly what you would call a liberal secular organization. But I think the key is let them vote about it. Don't try to find some dictatorial cheat. Don't try to find a successor to Abbas and say, "All right, now we'll work it out." Don't do those things that we've done in the past. Let them vote. And if they vote against, they vote against. And I suspect in a free vote, they will vote against. But maybe not. But that's the answer. And until that happens, until the Muslims themselves work it out, until the Palestinians work it out, then I would do nothing at all with the peace process.
Well, that would be a mistake. That would be a mistake. Not to do anything. I think you're right. I think you set the bar too high when you say, well, until Islam changes, we can't do anything. That's defeatist and fatalistic. I don't disagree. I mean, look, the reason the peace process collapsed in 2000 was a very, very simple, elemental, atavistic kind of idea. You know, I mean, Yasser Arafat could not recognize that the Temple Mount was Jewish. which is not to say that it's not also now Muslim, but it couldn't recognize it. And, you know, Bill Clinton sort of, and it's in his memoirs, he looked at him and said, look, everybody knows it's Jewish, what are you talking about? But Ruel's right. You know, Islam is a relatively recent religion that made up for its newness by grafting onto the past and saying that everything that happened in the past that you thought was Jewish and Christian is actually Muslim. And so that has an archaeological, actually geographic quality to it as well. So it fell apart on Jerusalem. So the answer, because there won't be a peace deal over Jerusalem, which is really the most most difficult final status issue, the answer to that is, well, let's not talk about anything, I think. And what you can do is you can create some conditions on the ground that ready the ground for the day when something different happens. And, you know, obviously I think that for Israel's sake, if it wants to maintain its status as a Jewish majority democracy, it has to figure out how to disengage itself from the lives of the Palestinians of the West Bank. The way not to do that is to continue to build settlements that entangle Israel more in the lives of these Palestinians. And to say that is not to say Israel should pull out right away from the West Bank unilaterally if necessary. It's to say, don't make the situation worse. You can say the same thing to the Palestinians. Don't sell your people, don't sell in schools and elsewhere, stories, lies that perpetuate the conflict. That's a more difficult one in the sense that, you know, it's very, very hard to get a Palestinian to acknowledge, a Palestinian leader or intellectual, to acknowledge a Jewish connection to any of that land. Because if you do that, you blow up the entire Palestinian narrative, which is that Zionism is a colonial imposition rather than a story about a group of people coming back to the place that they once were. But there are things that both sides can do. And so I tend to think that Ruel is right. You know, you're not gonna get Muslims to suddenly say, well, you know what, a Jewish state, not such a bad idea. On the other hand, you can create conditions on the ground that lower the temperature, that at least hold out the possibility for an eventual deal.
Okay, Fred, pull the mic up, and then after Fred is Britt Hume, and then Rob Gifford.
Ruel, I wanted to follow up with you about Christians being gone from the Middle East. My question is, how does this happen? Is it self-deportation, or are they driven out, or what? And is one reason that it can't happen in Egypt is just because there are so many of them. But there are a lot in Syria, too, and Lebanon. And
immigration is the primary way. I mean, I think it's a slow process. I mean, the communities have been immigrating for quite some time. You don't really know the real numbers in the Middle East. Everybody lies about percentages in the Middle East.
Why? Know? Why?
Because everybody's...
No good census in most places.
Everybody's extremely sensitive about the issue of who's the majority, who's the minority. I mean, there were Iraqi Sunnis who profoundly believed that they were over 50% of the population when they were really around 20% of the population. You want to believe your numbers are greater than they are, and you want to believe that the other guy, his numbers are a lot less. So I don't know whether the cops are still 10% of the population. They might be 15% of the population. My guess would be is that a significant number of cops have left the country. It's harder now. Once upon a time, for example, if you're a Lebanese Christian and you went into a French consulate, they'd more or less give you a visa, just like that. The French don't do that anymore. So the escape valves for the Christian minorities in the Middle East have become fewer. But the trajectory of this is fairly clear. I think the Syrian Christians, I mean, I'll stop there. I think that I'm hopeful the Syrian Christians don't get hit with what the Alawis are going to get hit with. Because the Syrian Christians, for the most part, have been sympathetic to the Assad regime for very understandable reasons, because they were a minority heretical Shiite community lording it over the Sunnis. So therefore, they ally themselves with another minority, and their position was pretty sound because everybody really has historically, was a minority community, has feared the Sunnis. Well, now the Sunnis are having their revenge. And it's I would not be surprised if we see 100,000 to 200,000 Alawis die. That's plus what we've seen die already. I think that's not a high figure. It could be worse than that. in my you know, sit down and pray that the Christians don't get hit with that fury too.
So. Jeffrey? Oh, that was good. Okay. Britt, you're up next. Please pull the mic over to yourself, Britt, and make sure that little green light is on.
It is. Thank you. Jeffrey, you had an interesting thesis last night about the state of play between President Obama and Benjamin Netanyahu and the issue of Iran and a nuclear weapon. I'd like to hear you on it again, and I'd sort of like to hear Ruel's response to it.
Can't remember what I said.
You were talking. Did you write it down anywhere?
Was it smart, though? Did you stipulate that I said something smart?
Yeah, I said it was striking.
Wow.
Well, basically what you said was that Netanyahu has now sort of decided he's going to trust President Obama.
Well, he's got no choice. I mean, the interesting thing about the relationship at the moment is that, you know, Netanyahu was in the driver's seat for much of last year in the sense that, you know, Obama would never acknowledge, nobody would, that that Netanyahu had the power to subvert his election campaign or derail his election campaign by launching a unilateral strike on Iran. But that threat was there, and in part because of that, in part because I think Obama genuinely worries about a nuclear Iran, Obama over the last couple of years has taken some pretty decisive steps, not only rhetorically, although the rhetoric is important, but on sanctions and some other issues, sabotage. He did that in part to make sure that the Israelis were on the same page and weren't going to go do something precipitous. I mean, you know, it's always interesting when they have these P5+1 meetings, and, you know, they've had four of them between the Iranians and the Western powers. Wendy Sherman, the State Department official who does them, she leaves these P5+1 and goes to Jerusalem to tell Netanyahu what happened, just to sort of say, this is what we're doing, calm down, don't worry about it. Election was over. Netanyahu gave Obama a great gift in September when he went to the UN and he said, you know, I'm looking at the numbers and it seems like we have another 6 to 9 months before they reach the 240 kilograms of, you know, medium-enriched uranium that they need to go to breakout. And so that was a huge favorite of Obama, but, you know, you give that. Now that Obama's passed he's run his last campaign, he's free to do what he wants, and so now he has more power to tell Netanyahu, look, this is the way it's going to go, and you really don't have much room here. So Netanyahu, to a degree that no Israeli prime minister has ever done, has basically subcontracted out the security of his country to the Americans, which this is really a profound moment, because it's, you know, and what happened was for Netanyahu, and this is just find this so interesting analytically, you know, Israeli, I don't want to go on at length, but Israeli defense, is this what we were talking about, or was it something really
different?
Oh, good.
I was trying to get to the profound moment.
Yeah. I'm going to drop it on you right now. This to me is Israeli, you know, Israeli defense, national security strategy has been built for the last 40 years on two pillars. One is maintain Israel's nuclear monopoly in the Middle East. Never let an adversary gain hold of a nuclear weapon. That's sort of the Auschwitz directive, right? Never let anybody who says they're going to kill you get the means to kill you. And the second is never get on the bad side of an American president, because you need the American president for all the things that Israel needs an American president for. Here you had this conflict. They ran up against each other, and I really see it as basic as, you know, they had a staring contest, and Netanyahu blinked in September, and now he's, from his perspective, paying the consequence for it. I happen to trust Obama more on this question than I guess Netanyahu does. You know, that Obama is serious when he says he means to stop Iran, with the obvious caveat that America has promised to stop other rogue regimes from getting hold of nuclear weapons and has failed, Pakistan and North Korea, so we're 0 for 2. Israelis say, of course, that they're 2 for 2 because they stopped Iraq and they stopped Syria. All that said, you know, it's in Obama's hands now. It really is in Obama's hands now. It might be actually, we don't know, it might be too late for Israel to do something operationally. Certainly Obama has the means to put more pressure on Netanyahu now that he's free of election worries not to do something. And so we're heading into a very, very interesting phase.
We get Raul's comment on it. I just want to comment that I need to let you all know that Jeffrey is leaving later today to cover President Obama in the Middle East, and so he's having to leave later this afternoon. Will you be able to talk to him about this point?
Talk to who?
Mr. President.
Oh, yeah, because I'm going to get within 3 miles of him. Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. This is a presidential – Britain knows very well. Presidential trips are almost – you know, you're always filled with regret as soon as you go on them.
You feel what?
You're filled with regret as soon as you go
you
on.
You travel near the president, but not with him.
Yeah, you travel near.
Travel near.
Yeah.
I would say that sounded almost like an Allstate commercial. You're in your hands with
the. Yeah, no, there.
The Obama administration, the most intelligent thing it did with Israel, I think, was when State and the CIA and the Pentagon sent a team over to Israel to talk to their military and intelligence folks about the Iranian nuclear program. They did it with the explicit intention to undermine Netanyahu and Barak, because they knew that quite understandably, the Israeli military and their intelligence was incredibly nervous about bombing the Iranian nuclear sites. And so the team went over there, and they reinforced the nervousness about that, and they did also something quite thoughtful, and they shared a lot of information, and they discussed in a very collegial way the whole effort, and I think it actually robbed Netanyahu and Barak of their own support structure within their own military and their intelligence service. It was a good chess stroke. Listen, I mean, I think the Israelis, like all liberal democracies, have a really hard time going to war. They also have the little issue that they only have 5,000-pound bombs and they have 70 airplanes. No matter how you cut it, it's just not, and they probably only get one wave, depending what the Hezbollah does. It's just bad arithmetic and very bad physics. So I don't think the Americans have to do much to discourage the Israelis. The real issue is whether Obama, does he really mean it? And I'm skeptical of that. I'm more skeptical than Jeffrey is. I don't think his entire approach to the Middle East, I don't really think the president wants to get involved in a third war, which could turn out to be the most significant of all three wars we've been in. I just don't think he wants to do that. I think it would seriously reverse his whole approach to the region, his understanding of the Islamic world. It would have significant impacts upon the defense budget, et cetera, and also his choices of Mr. Kerry and who's our Secretary of Defense?
Mr. Hagel.
Thank you, Mr. Hagel. I don't think that those indicate a particularly aggressive stance on his part.
Okay. Rob, if you would pull the microphone up. Ladies and gentlemen, Rob Gifford is the person who's come the furthest from anyone, from London, from The Economist, to be with us. So, Rob, I should have probably called on you first. But
no, at all.
I want you to get warmed
and I'm
up.
I'm sorry to live up to stereotypes and talk about the invisible hand and not the invisible God. But I wanted to also, I cover China, so hearing the Muslim Brotherhood and their sort of agenda. Xi Jinping, the new president of China, has just stood up and said economic development is our main priority. And so I just, that's the sort of one thing we haven't got into. And aside from basket weaving and tourism, where is, say, the Egyptian economy? How important is it in terms of just lifting those millions of people out of poverty, and how does that feed into, obviously, the politics of the region? And specifically, you know, as a non-expert looking at it, you'd always see that the Muslim Brotherhood, the people in their poverty always rallied to the Muslim Brotherhood to oppose Mubarak. Well, what happens when the Muslim Brotherhood are in power and those people are still poor? Who do they rally to? And what? How does that affect the dynamics in the slums of Cairo? Well,
very quickly, just a quick point. Poverty has a very bright future in Egypt, obviously. And because poverty has a very bright future in Egypt, it calls into question the Muslim Brotherhood's future in Egypt. I mean, this is what obviously would dislodge them, if anything. I mean, Egypt is plumb out of money, as you know. you know, since the, you know, Arab Spring of 2 years ago, you know, I think there's, you know, saw some number, 2.5 million new babies. You know, I mean, there's just so many surplus males in the working population that that revolution is inevitable. This is why, of course, you know, there's a certain analysis that holds that the Muslim Brotherhood didn't actually want power this quickly, because it understood, they know enough about economics to know that you got to have some jobs or else you're going to get thrown out. So the real question comes, what happens when the people revolt against the Muslim Brotherhood rule, assuming that the trajectory stays the same, right? Will the Muslim Brotherhood figure out a way to stay in power through force, or will they actually move out of power? I think they will try to stay through force, but Roel can answer the question about what they're actually trying to do to build their economy.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's too soon to tell. I mean, certainly the Muslim Brotherhood has made sounds that they'd like to go in the path of the Justice and Development Party in Turkey, which, as if you cast your mind back, you know, the Kemalist regime was a very state-controlled command economy, and the Justice and Development advocated much more free enterprise, and, you know, the great growth of free enterprise in central Turkey was driven largely by people of faith. The FIS sort of was going in that direction in Algeria. They made noises about it. But I think all the Muslim Brotherhood has is more comfortable historically with a more socialist approach to the economy. So it's going to be something to watch to see where they go. But I don't think they can do anything within the time frame that is open to them. I will just say this. I think the Brotherhood is in a better position to withstand turbulent times than anyone else is in Egypt, because they are so culturally attuned to Egyptians, to the common man, that they're more likely to be able to remain popular in difficult times. That's not to say that they can't be overturned. I think they could be. But I would not expect to see the Muslim Brotherhood evanesce rapidly if Egypt were to go bankrupt.
I think you have a follow-up, Rob.
Yeah, I'm just interested because the hopelessness of the hopelessness that fed the Arab Spring seems to continue. And, you know, I was based in Shanghai when the Arab Spring happened, and there were these calls on overseas Chinese websites to say, go down to People's Square, you know, and start a Chinese Spring. And so we all trooped down there, and the Western reporters were here, and the Chinese police were here, and the people of Shanghai were too busy shopping to join the revolution. And that was the story we all wrote, and it is extraordinary. And obviously, China's a whole different world from the Middle East. But there is a sort of hope in China for all the dreadfulness that goes on, and it just seems that hope is just still 2 years on totally lacking, and the poverty continues. You really saying they're going to be able to maintain power and support when the jobs continue not to come?
I think they'll be able to do a better job of that than many people think.
Why?
Because of the power of culture. And the distance that the secular liberal crowd is from lots of Egyptians. Now, again, I think they can be seriously hurt, and they could be overturned. There's no doubt that I think the Muslim Brotherhood could lose an election, that you could see faithful Egyptians vote against them in large numbers. But that may not be a quick process. It may not be what we're accustomed to, where the economy goes badly and boom, you're out with the next election. You may discover that they have a bit more traction in their own society.
It's also pretty easy for the Muslim Brotherhood government, if the economy goes south, to pull a kind of a Castro and argue that, well, this is a conspiracy of the West and the IMF to screw us proud Muslims, and we'll stand together, or they'll vanquish us, and that's calling on the power of culture, calling on the power of paranoia, which is a huge factor in Egyptian culture. So it's perfectly plausible that they can stay in power without guns, without using guns.
And also, I just say that there's a certain elasticity out there that I think people tend to ignore, that the black economy, even though things are absolutely awful, that the black economy is often sufficient to keep people going when you think the numbers just don't add up. And I think there'll be a bit of that in Egypt, that you know, people are used to making do with so little that there may be a pretty long fuse on this, longer than what we would expect.
Okay, John Seneff, and then Tim Dalrymple.
Okay, so serendipitously, I follow Rob's question because I had the same thought that when did economics become kind of a bit player in the region? It seems to me the underpinning of U.S. foreign policy for so long has at least to some degree been on economics. And when you look at the vacuum, like the Sadrists in Iraq, as a way of gaining power and influence through basically feeding the people infrastructure, things that government doesn't do very well in the Middle East. And I'm wondering, going forward, how should that, that being the case, of if economics has become to a degree a bit player, how should that redirect U.S. foreign policy and our limitless resources in dealing with the region?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. I mean, on Egypt, you know, the United States obviously doesn't have as much money as it used to. I would still say that, you know, given the amount that foreign aid takes, you could give an awful lot of money, and it's not really all that much money. But, you know, that's hard to sometimes get through in Congress. I think you need to condition aid. I mean, you just don't want to give aid blindly. And I think in the case of Egypt, I certainly would shift the historic American priority on weaponry. I'm not a very great believer in the military-industrial complex, except in the Middle East. And I think the United States has had a fairly egregious policy, with some exceptions, to use military goods as an economic aid tool, and also because it creates very strong relationships, so we like to believe, between militaries. And you make the American taxpayer pay for, you know, the tanks you send to Egypt. I think that ought to stop. I can't think of a single scenario where the Egyptian military getting new weaponry either benefits the United States or benefits the Egyptian people. It never made a lot of sense, and it really doesn't make sense now.
Is anybody listening to you on that point?
Well, you know, our little Egypt group, you know, we try. I don't know. I think there is some headway making there. I think people do realize that the Egyptian military is not necessarily our friends. And in addition to that, you really don't want to create a situation whereby you're essentially giving weaponry to the Muslim Brotherhood.
Right.
I think conditioned aid is the key. I think the United States ought to be generous. But it can't be a blank check. Obviously, if the Muslim Brotherhood acts in certain ways, you don't want to give them money.
Okay, Tim Dalrymple, please pull the mic. And then John Ward.
Yeah, I write largely about American Christianity and especially evangelicalism, so this is a bit outside my wheelhouse, but it strikes me that American evangelicals have spoken, I would say, with a pretty cohesive voice on the issue of support for Israel and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, not so much on issues like women's rights in the Muslim world. And so this is a question really for both of you. If you could see American Christians and evangelicals in particular engage with the Middle East in different ways, what would you like to see?
It's funny you say that. We were talking about this at dinner a little bit last night. As an outsider, I represent the third small branch of monotheism, the wee little small branch. I, as an outsider, I look at the condition of Christians in the Middle East, in a dozen places, and not just the Middle East, across the Muslim world, from Nigeria to Pakistan, and I'm sort of flummoxed by the lack of Christian interest in the condition of their spiritual brethren. I mean, you know, we were talking last night, the outright persecution, the burning of churches, the stealing of property, the killing of people, the false charges of blasphemy. I mean, you know, if you, the whole range of things. It's astonishing. I haven't gotten a reasonable explanation yet for why Christian churches in America don't spend more time lobbying, advocating, arguing, you know, pressuring this government to do more for Christians in places like this. I just never understood it.
Well, you'll have an answer by the time this session is over.
I'm sure I will.
I have it for you. But, okay.
You want to share?
Well, the founding of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom was rooted in evangelical concern about persecution and human rights abuses around the world, and that was signed in the late 90s by President Clinton, the formation of the U.S. Commission. And that commission has done its best to try to highlight these things, and there's pockets of friends like Nina Easton and Paul Marshall and others around the country who are constantly raising this. But you're right, though, in relation to the amount of persecution and the amount of noise being
in relationship raised, to the number of Christians in America.
Right. So we're glad that Dr. Keller is here to put that in his next sermon. If he'd like to comment, we'd be glad to hear it. But anyway, I mean, there is a movement, but you're right, Jeffrey. It's not like there's 20,000 Christians in front of embassies in Washington protesting like there should be. That's on the record. John Ward, you're up next. Wait a minute. Roland, did you want to comment on that?
Yes, I mean, it's a very tricky question. I mean, if there's to be a productive reaction, I think you have to make Muslims feel guilty. And that's not as hard as it sounds. Because when you do have these type of anti-Christian explosions in the Middle East, and you do have anti-Christian persecution, you can easily say that these are anti-Islamic, that there is a tradition inside of Islam which guarantees basic, what we would call basic human rights, certainly life of, you know, protection of life and property. So that's where I would go with those criticisms. I would be very careful in trying to set it up as a clash of civilizations. That's where I think you need to be a little bit careful. And you want to try to instill guilt. Guilt is good. Make people feel guilty.
On this point, Peter Boyer, on guilt.
But that guilt trip thing hasn't worked out so well in stopping terrorism, which is also anti.
It's worked out. It actually has had an effect. It's just that the tolerance level is a lot higher than we would like to see it. There's no doubt that, I mean, for example, let's look at Iraq. The Sunni capacity to see Shiites suffer is very large. Very large. But without a doubt, when the Arab world began, Arab Sunni world began seeing mosque after mosque being blown up, Shiite mosque being blown up by Sunnis, when they saw women and children, women or children are always a good thing to focus on, when they saw Shiite women and children being blown to pieces by Sunni holy warriors, it had a significant effect. It took time. It took much more time than one would like. But it does have an effect. You just have to keep the focus on it. But it is, there's no doubt about it, the response that you find in the Middle East to these issues isn't rapid.
And by the way, it's not. This is not uniform across the Muslim world. In Jordan, for instance, and uncannily, I've become the spokesman for the Hashemite court. I mean, you have in Jordan, in Morocco, in many monarchies, you have a kind of acceptance and tolerance for Christians that you don't have in many other places. And even in Turkey, I mean, this is why, going back to what Ruel said about the Ottoman, you know, Erdogan is a terrible anti-Semite, but he has this Ottoman approach to his Jews, which is to say that I'll protect my those Jews I don't like, but these Jews who live here, they're part of the Ottoman mosaic, and so I'm going to protect them. And Christianity has the same status. So, I mean, you do find a range of responses.
In Jordan, they just hate Shiites. They don't hate Christians.
I don't know why you hate Jordan so much. I just don't understand. I don't understand it. It's inexplicable. Did he say something to you? Did he do something? Did he hurt your feelings once, the little king?
The little king? No, it's just that he is...
That was rhetorical. I wasn't expecting an answer.
Okay. Tim Keller, will you, before I go to John Ward, just comment on evangelicals and persecution and why there might be a lack of rising concern about fellow Christians who are being persecuted. And do you have any...
No, I don't know. I mean, obviously, evangelicals are Protestants. An awful lot of the persecuted Christians are very, very old Christian communities that are not Protestant, and they're not even Catholic. They're various forms of older, you know, Christian communities before even, you know, the split between the East and West. That's part of it. In other words, they don't. You know, evangelicals are very relational. They get around the world, and they see people, they talk to people, and they don't mix. That's all. The other thing I was just saying to Peter was that what I like about what Rule said is I wouldn't actually say guilt, but the point is the way you change somebody's opinion is you find something in their own belief system to use against them. You don't just beat on them and say, you know, you're primitive and we're enlightened. You have to go inside and say, well, what do you already believe? Wait a minute, you're not being true to your own beliefs. And you use that against them, that's powerful. But just beating on them gets nowhere. And I think that's another way I would have put it, rather than just say, make them feel guilty. But
is there something within our tradition that you could feel?
Oh, yeah.
I don't know. And you know, Saturday school, the rabbi always just said guilt. So, I mean, I mean, but you know more about that than I do. So.
About guilt?
Guilt. You know more about
guilt. I know much more about guilt.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, I would just observe about American evangelicals that they seem far more energized about support for Israel than persecution than raising this issue of persecution of Christians.
Because that has a direct theological component as opposed to just a humanitarian? Is that what you mean?
I just think it's ironic that there's so little.
Certainly historically ironic, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
One more aside, I really liked your use of the phrase culturally attuned and cultural power because the GOP in the U.S., I'm a political reporter, the GOP in the U.S. right now is adrift. Everybody's talking about tactics and strategy and whether they should change positions. I think they're just not culturally attuned to a large part of the country. I just think it's interesting to observe in this context the power of culture in the political sphere. I think that's really a compelling idea. My questions are twofold. One, I wanted to clarify what you said, Roel, about Ahmadinejad's mentor. You said he was the lone voice standing up for it.
No, I said he's really only the first grade mind that still defends a clerical dictatorship. That the rest of the rest of the intellectual community in Iran, both lay and clerical, has gone the other way.
Okay, because you used the term theocracy, which I thought fundamentalism was in favor of. But
well, no, Sunni fundamentalism actually isn't okay. Necessarily in favor of theocracy. That's the Shiite tradition.
Okay. Okay. And then my other question would be more theological, which may not be best for this setting, but it comes off of your comment about how Muslims do not focus on the heart but on the public square. Simple question, why is that? I've never heard that, and maybe that's a sign of my ignorance, but I found it very interesting.
That's a very good question. There is a fundamental difference. Islam is like Judaism, is very theologically weak, all right? The core...
Theologically
weak. There isn't a great deal of time and effort spent on theology. It's about the law. And Islam focuses on the law. The law is where it's at, and as I said, it's not orthodoxy is orthopraxy. It's how you practice the law, and the notion that another man can intrude into another man's mind and know his soul is just for the most part, with the exception of some Sufis, is a fairly foreign concept in Islam, so certainly traditional Islam. So the objective for salvation is one where you personally have to deal with the Almighty directly, all right? And that's between you and the Almighty. It's not really anyone else's business. And if you're bad, then the Almighty is going to come Judgment Day, is going to exact a terrible price. But all the state can do and all the state should do is maintain the public square so public morality, the mores of society, follow the Islamic, the primary Islamic commandments, you might say. But it's the concern about the soul, the Christian use of soul, is for the most part, historically, it's fairly rare in Islam. And when you do see it, it has to do with the Sufi tradition, which, by the way, is highly influenced by Christianity. But for your traditional Sunni, Shiite, clerical discussion, the soul just doesn't come in there very much. It is about the law.
And obeying it. And they believe the state can enforce that obedience.
Well, for the public square, yeah. I mean, there aren't a lot. The notion that you intrude, I mean, that's where I gave the example of Khomeini in 82, when the real revolutionaries, the Iranian revolutionaries, who were very westernized, they wanted to say, no, you know, Armenians can't drink either. I mean, drinking is bad. But Khomeini said, no, I mean, they're Christians. They can drink. They have the whole notion of what they call in the Quran, khamra, covering your mind. They can drink whatever they want. They can grow grapes. So he followed a very classical understanding of the law. The law says that Muslims may not drink, but Christians may do what they want. They just can't intrude into Muslim life. They can't bring their booze with them into the public square.
So. Jeffrey, I think you probably have a comment on this. And if it's related to guilt, we're open to it.
No, I don't have anything to say on guilt. I was remembering, I was in the Serena Hotel in Quetta in Pakistan years ago, and there's a little, Quetta's like, you know, makes Islamabad look like Tel Aviv or something, I don't know. It's a tough place, but there's a little sign on in your room, a special number to call. It says, liquor is available for non-Muslims only. Call whatever, and they'll come to your room, and they'll bring you a bottle of gin. So they don't, you know, I mean, and the Muslim will touch it, bring it to you, sell it to you, won't drink it. Well, not in front of you, obviously. But, on this broader question, I think Raul answered it well. I mean, you know, you just have to remember, there's no, in Islam, there's no render unto Caesar concept. I mean, there's no separation. So it's all politics in a kind of way. The idea of political Islamism almost is a redundancy. You know, I mean, it doesn't. And so I think you're right. You're dealing with Judaism is actually, I mean, it's much more similar to Judaism in some ways in terms of the legal code. In Israel, you know, you do certainly have people in Israel now more than ever who are trying to impose more of that legal code onto the society. But Israel is an example of a state, you know, built around a faith community that nevertheless kept religious law mainly out of the public square. It's being pushed in the Muslim world. You just see a far more advanced version of that.
Jeffrey, I think before I call on David, this is an important time for you to tell us the story you told last night about visiting the Islamic seminary.
Oh, I don't think it's an important story or a good time to tell that.
It's a great time to tell it.
Is this the one about buggery?
No, it's not about buggery. Well, it's all about buggery.
That story about visiting there, and I think this would be helpful for one.
Well, no, but that story illustrates another. Well, fine, I'll tell the story.
While we're talking about theology, I think it's
it's an interesting story because it sort of goes to the contradictions of how, you know, certain people who you don't think could live with you could actually live with you in certain circumstances. This is years ago. Ruel remembers this because we were both traveling at the same time. This was in Pakistan in 1999. There was this madrasa near Peshawar that had graduated Mullah Omar and other main figures in the Taliban, and I decided I wanted to go become a student there, because an affirmative action program I was hoping for. And so I presented myself. This was before Danny Pearl, so we all were wandering around Pakistan like idiots. Actually, I was on that trip last, like when I first met Danny, I think. And I went to this madrasa, 6,000 students. It's a big place, and really sort of a Taliban army, you know, sort of a feeder school to the Taliban in Afghanistan, mostly Pashtun kids from Afghanistan. And I wormed my way into a meeting with the head of the Samuel Haq, the head of the seminary, and I told him that I just wanted to learn what you're teaching and what you were doing. And
you tell him you were a journalist?
Of course. It was New York Times at the time, New York Times Magazine. He was very open to it, and we were chatting and sort of getting to know each other, and he sort of conspiratorially looked at me, and he said, you know, the real problem isn't between you know, you Christians and us Muslims, it's the Jews. And, you know, I had to make that decision that, you know, came naturally. I said, well, you know, I'm Jewish. And he looked at me and he said, well, you are most welcome here. You know, I don't try to derive too many, you know, I don't derive too many lessons from that. I mean, there's one important lesson, which is when the safest place you can be is in the home of a terrorist. Because when you're in the home, you're the guest. It's like when you go back out in the street, it's a little dicey because of the overwhelming sense of hospitality. There is, I think the dominant lesson from that period was, you know, the role of fantasy and paranoia in the creation of thinking. We were talking last night again about another kind of aspect, and we always forget this when we have rational based discussions about Egypt. We forget that we have a set of facts that don't correspond to the set of facts possessed by the Muslim Brotherhood. And I was talking, we were talking for a minute about the Hamas charter. And again, this goes back to Rael's point about reading, like actually going and reading the things that these people write and say, and looking at their speeches and trying to understand, even though it can be highly unpleasant because it does not conform to this American notion that we're all alike. There's no difference between us, and we're all, you know, we all want the same things: happy children and a safe, nice house. And in reading the Hamas charter, there's some, you know, obviously horrific parts of it, but there are also some inadvertently amusing parts. One of them is the statement of fact that Islam is confronting a worldwide conspiracy that's run by the Jews, but includes as its components the Freemasons and the Rotary Club. And what we forget, and this is something that's deeply held. It's a deeply, and I brought this up with, because I read it, and this is when the late Sheikh Yassin was still alive. I went to him, and we were talking about something else, and I looked at him, and I said, by the way, the Rotary Club? I got a $50 scholarship in high school from the Rotary Club in my town. You know, I mean, it was like they didn't seem bent on world domination. He said, this is proof that the Rotary Club is very powerful because you are bringing it up to deny that it's very powerful. And I thought, this is not a guy built for success in the modern fact-based world. I mean, that's the problem that you're dealing with in Egypt is we're having one conversation at them, and they're having another conversation back, and they think the world is organized in a certain way. You know, anti-Semitism is the socialism of fools. It's also the, you know, they don't have a grasp on reality as it actually is, and that makes it very hard to actually have a useful conversation with them, because they think that there is a global conspiracy designed to destroy their way of life.
Just a quick comment on that. There's a phrase in Persian which is always important to remember, and it's called pushte pade, which means things that happen behind the curtain. And that's the way that Muslims have always seen power. The power, they had no access to it. It occurred amongst the elite, behind the curtains, and God knows what happened there. And so it was a natural breeding ground for conspiracy. I don't say many kind things about the Islamic Revolution in Iran, but one thing I can say is that they have become more responsible. And this is actually, that is, they blame themselves. And that's an important achievement. And you can actually see this also in the Arab world. It's not as advanced because they've only recently become more responsible for themselves. But in Iran, they talk about it all the time. They talk about the idea of masuliyat, of responsibility, that we cannot blame the Americans, we cannot blame the English, we have to blame ourselves for what we've done. That is an incredibly important step, and it's the first step to getting away from the conspiracies and the conspiracy mongering, which Jeffrey very well put it, just debilitates society.
But let me just add here, and I do now that the session is coming toward a close, and I do regret that we don't have a Muslim journalist here. I apologize. I should have found one, because what then, Jeffrey or Royal, would that person possibly say to everything you've just said? I mean, do you know some in Washington?
Depends on the journalist.
What's that?
It depends on, you know.
It depends on the journalist. Yeah.
There's no monolith here.
There's no monolith.
Yeah, I mean,
is that your experience?
Well, yeah. I mean, the first prime minister of Iran wrote a very, after the revolution, Barzagan wrote a very, very good book about conspiracy, about the problems of conspiracy. I mean, they are aware of it. It depends, but it's just one of those surreal things. I mean, you can go and have a very wonderful dinner in Egypt with the Egyptian elite, and you can just pick your Arab country. Same thing happened in Turkey, and then all of a sudden you touch a subject and it just rockets into the land of the surreal, and you are wondering, am I still with the same people? And the answer is yes, you
yeah.
are.
Yeah. You've had that experience?
Well, many times, but one final point, I'm sorry. It's on the issue of conspiracy. I mean, it's... The truth is, we think of ourselves as, you know, as benign, and we're not trying to push an agenda on anyone. But I remember, you know, it's a good exercise to try to look at the world the way a fundamentalist looks at it. And I had this experience once. It was when the Taliban was still in power in Afghanistan, and they're not going to be in power again for another 2 years at least, probably. And I was having lunch with the then foreign minister, Mutawakil. Remember him? And he was interesting because he had spent like 8 days in New York once, you know, so he was a worldly guy. No, he was like the world, you know. And we were going through, and he's running through the conspiracies, and I mean, and the usual sort of, you know, Western inflected stuff, the Freemasons and this and the licentiousness and everything. And you know, his critiques of America were mainly crazy, but you know, he made a couple of good, you know, he was telling me about his observations of America, and you know you objectify women, you put them in pictures and underwear on billboards, and would you like your daughter to be there? And I was like, I get your point. And then he said two things. He said, and the last one is the most amazing one, he said look at the inferiority of your culture. You know, you take your old people who you should venerate, and you segregate them in buildings for old people, and you never visit them, and then they die alone. And I said, okay, I get where you're coming from. And then he said, and the most shocking thing is you worship your dogs. You walk outside with your dog each morning, and you bend down to pick up their shit and put it in bags, and the dog is the master of the human. And dogs have a bad reputation in Islam because the Prophet didn't like them. And I thought, yeah, that's really true. That's actually really true. No, I get that one. But in other words, it is really worth listening. You don't have to buy into the, you know, the Masonic protocols of the Elders of Zion piece of this to understand how they could see things that we do that are perfectly banal to us as threatening a certain way of life. And so, you know, when we say... The point about Egypt and secular parties, one of the items the Muslim Brotherhood objected to last week in the UN Declaration was the UN Declaration calls for equal inheritance rights between men and women. The daughters should inherit just the way sons inherit. And, you know, to us, it's sort of like, well, why is that a discussion? The Muslim Brotherhood finds it objectionable, but the important thing to note is that there's no party in Egypt that wants to reform Egypt's laws to make equitable inheritance laws. all the inheritance. I mean, the inheritance laws are weighted toward the sons, and nobody wants to change that. So, like, we sometimes forget, you know, that secularism is not our definition of secularism.
I would just recommend very quickly, I think the book is still available, my good friend Peter Theroux, Paul's younger brother, Peter Theroux wrote a phenomenal book on Saudi Arabia. It is also the funniest book ever written on Saudi Arabia, maybe the only funny book ever written on Saudi Arabia, called Sandstorm. And what Peter does in that, like no one else I've ever seen, is to reverse angles of observation. So one moment you're seeing Americans as Saudis would see them, and then Americans looking at Saudis, and he goes back and forth like that. And it is just brutally funny, and it's brutally honest. And I recommend it highly to get it helps you see the world through their lens, and that is, as Jeffrey said, a highly commendable thing to do.
Okay. David Bornstein, I think you'll be having our last question. Well, so the pressure is on.
Yeah. Well, this has been wonderfully informative and also entertaining. So just for argument's sake, let's say 20 years from now you're both completely wrong. And there's
quite a high possibility.
A female head of state in Egypt, and they're heading towards pluralism in a steady way. What could have happened? What are the surprises, the areas that we're not looking at, the reporting we should be doing now that could potentially have explained all of the things that can't possibly happen, given the conversation we've just heard? What could happen? Where might there be changes that we're not looking at? The surprises.
My imagination is impoverished. I can't imagine. Do you have any thoughts on that? I'll think about it.
You know, this is going to sound really odd. The first thing that came in my mind was Barney, you know, the purple dinosaur.
But that's your answer for everything.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. if we discover that Sesame Street and Barney, who's that? Who's that New York writer who did that thing about Barney coming to Paris? That if we discover that there is more of an appetite for Sesame Street and Barney in Egypt, and there is more feminization of in Egypt than I think there is. And I emphasize that a part of Westernization, a very healthy part of Westernization, is feminization. Islam, I don't want to go into...
Feminization?
Yes. I don't want to go into a long history of Islam here, but I mean, Islam is and this is going to sound invidious, it's a very masculine faith. It appeals to men for a reason. And the...
But there are a lot of female...
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you cannot visit a shrine, and particularly shrines dedicated to women, without also understanding the power that Islam has for female believers. But I just say there is a... Islam does something that is... It makes every man a king in his home. And that's one reason why family structure in the Islamic world, I think, has been fairly solid, is that it really does... Islamic societies are often very unkind, but they do grant the believer that within his home he at least is sovereign. And I think that is very, very appealing, can be very, very appealing to men. So if we discover that actually the what I would call the feminization of Westernization, that is more advanced than it at least appears to be now, then that's possible. You don't want it to be, I mean, in Pakistan you've had, you know, obviously with Benazir's Bhutto, but that doesn't count because those are family tribal issues. If you come from the right family, family can trump sex, all right? It can trump gender. I don't think that actually is the case in Egypt, but in a place like Pakistan it was. But that's what I would say. If something like that happened, I would say that I missed that completely, and that aspect of Westernization was vastly more profound than what I thought it was.
You know, it's interesting. One of the reasons that Egypt doesn't have a bright short-term future is that there are not enough opportunities for young men to become kings of their own homes. I mean, you can't get married unless you have money. You can't have money unless you have a job. There are no jobs. You can't have sex unless you have money and therefore a wife. I mean, the strictures are pretty tough. It's why you have a crazy sexual harassment problem. You have an incredible number of frustrated, unemployed males in their 20s. So, you know, the trajectory isn't good even sort of that traditional model. I mean, yes, there's something that we haven't seen, and there's nothing in the only constant in the Middle East is sudden and dramatic change. So there's no reason to think that something won't happen 5 years from now that we don't understand and can't foresee. It doesn't seem likely. Over the decades, will there be a reformation? Will there be some sort of modernization in the Middle East? Yeah, maybe in the next century or two, maybe in the coming decades. It could start next Tuesday. I mean, we don't know, but it doesn't
it's
seem.
It's started.
It's started, right. There's look, it's roiling, but I don't know, I don't see it landing in 20 years, certainly, mm-hmm. at a place that you're talking about.
Sally, you've got to pull the mic up. You can't speak without the mic. And John Ward also had a quick question, then we're going to break for
well,
lunch.
Well, you all sound like it's completely up to the men. I mean, what if the women just get really pissed? What if, Hillary Clinton is probably going to devote the rest of her career to furthering the cause of women. And, I mean, this has become a huge issue in this country, and they're working all over the Middle East.
But you're mirror imaging now. You're assuming because you want a certain thing as an American woman, that Egyptian woman wants the thing that you want.
I mean, in May 23rd, 1997, great day, it's my birthday. Send presents. Remember that day, May 23rd, my birthday. That May 23rd, thank you. May 23rd, 1997 was the day that Mohammad Khatami won the election in Iran. He would not have won that election without women voting. They overwhelmingly gave him that election. When he went to bed the night before they announced the returns, he thought he'd won 2 million votes. He wakes up, he finds out he wins 20 million votes. Mm-hmm. If women had been able to change the political system in the way they wanted to, the Islamic Republic would not be the threat that it is today. We would not worry about the Islamic Republic. Women did cast their votes in the right, what I would say that was the right way. They did express themselves, except they got crunched. I'm all for women getting as upset as possible. I think it's a grand idea. The only problem is if men strike back. The difference in strength is pronounced.
I mean, you could be Sheryl Sandberg here. It's a little harder to be Sheryl Sandberg there. You lean in, you might get punched in the face. Quite literally get punched in the face. So it is difficult. But it's a worthwhile question, and the American answer doesn't seem to be, I don't know if you were, I was with the former secretary in Tunisia where she was talking to, Muslim women. And Secretary Clinton a couple years ago on one of those trips. And, one of the things that you have to grapple with is that, and I have to grapple with, we all do, is that a lot of women are wearing the veil voluntarily, really voluntarily. I mean, maybe the cultural framework is such that there is no true free will in that, but they, really bold, young, bright, smart women said, explained to me after this particular speech that Hillary gave, who is she to, even imply that my choice is not the right choice. I don't go to America and tell her to, do X, Y, or Z. And so, it's just really, really complicated. And remember, millions of women voted for the Muslim Brotherhood, so there's something going on.
Yeah, but what I'm talking about is sort of the internal workings of the family. There is something called nagging. And, the wife can just nag her husband, and, suddenly it's not a happy home anymore.
Cause, I'd like the record to show that.
If mama ain't happy, ain't nobody happy.
I'd like that thing about
so instead
nagging,
of writing lean in, you should write whine on.
The thing about nagging, I'd like the record to show that I didn't say that.
I am woman.
We want to wrap up here for lunch.
I am woman. Hear me whine. I mean, in the mid to long term, I think what you have said is absolutely right. A very good friend of mine who has a rather difficult name, Farhad Hosrahavah, is this Franco-Iranian.
Say one more time for the transcriber.
He just makes these names
Farhad,
up.
Farhad Hosrahavah.
Havar.
That's what I thought you said.
But you can call him. You can call him Bob.
He actually just takes a French name, calls himself Frank because it's so hard. But he wrote a book called, which unfortunately hasn't been translated in English, called Being 20 in the Land of the Ayatollahs. And what he did is he went back when he could do this, he went to Qom, and the holy city, the clerical capital of Iran, and he spent 3 years with his team interviewing the children of the most senior clerics. And you cannot read those interviews of the young women, the daughters of the senior clergy, and not come away and say, oh, my God, they're westernized. And when it comes to the ideas of love, when it came to ideas of marriage, when it came to ideas of professional aspirations, when it came to the idea of what men should be, the influence is extraordinary. So you can look long-term and say, all right, eventually that's going to have an effect. However, men can be, or bad men, let's just say, can be tenacious. And, we don't live in a society where physical strength matters that much anymore. We do not live in societies where, you have violence just right next to you. If violence is there, men win, always.
Jeffrey, you had a final comment, I think.
No, I'm good.
Ladies and gentlemen, join me in thanking these men for their...